من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم. الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون. قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise." Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UN Security Council's recent authorization of an international stabilization force, the ISF, in Gaza has sparked sharp contention. Supporters frame it as a transitional mission to secure a ceasefire, enable humanitarian relief, and prepare for reconstruction. Critics, though, including Palestinian resistance movements, denounce it as an infringement on self-determination, while the European Union warns against altering Gaza's demographic and territorial integrity and insists on a two-state solution. The spotlight now turns on whether the ISF represents genuine stabilization or a new form of external control. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with the report.
The UN Security Council has voted in favor of a U.S. plan for Gaza, including supporting the establishment and deployment of an international stabilization force. Under the adopted resolution, foreign troops will operate under a unified command to secure the territory, oversee its demilitarization, and facilitate aid delivery through safe corridors. The measure passed overwhelmingly. However, major powers, Russia and China, abstained, arguing that the resolution fails to outline a clear role for the UN in Gaza's future and lacks enough detail on how it will be implemented.
In essence, the Council is giving its blessing to a U.S. initiative on the basis of Washington's promises, giving complete control over the Gaza Strip to the Board of Peace and the International Stabilization Force, the modalities of which we know nothing about so far.
The draft resolution is vague and unclear on many critical elements. It should have explained in detail their structure, composition, terms of reference, and criteria of preparation, among others. This should have been an essential basis for the Council's serious discussions. However, the draft resolution contains skimpy details on these critical elements.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also slammed the resolution, saying in a statement that it does not meet the political and humanitarian demands and rights of the Palestinian people. The group insisted that any international force must operate fully under UN supervision and only in coordination with official Palestinian institutions. Other resistance groups have expressed similar concerns, saying the resolution undermines Palestinians' right to self-determination and that it authorizes the U.S. to establish itself as an occupying power. The concerns are in line with repeated alarms that any initiative for the future of Gaza by the U.S. cannot be trusted by Palestinians. That's because Washington is widely known as an accomplice in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Betul Sobeiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Ajam Mubaraka, founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York in the U.S. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you. I'm going to start the conversation with Betul here. Betul, how do Palestinian resistance movements interpret the ISF resolution as undermining their right to self-determination?
Yes, let's talk about, you know, the demands of this, you know, so-called peace plan and this, you know, resolution. In terms of where Palestinian power lies, it talks about the reformation within the UN. Within the PA, it talks about, you know, the reconstruction process of allowing aid in. The ISF is supposedly to train Palestinians to disarm the resistance, to destroy the tunnels. These powers will be introduced to the Palestinian side that they decide should take over when all is ready. And we've seen a lot of back and forth to make this palatable and acceptable. The crux of all of this is that America is the one that wants to arrange the structures in the way that they see fit. Now, what does America not want? They don't want any Palestinian formation that is independent. If we just put the resistance on the side for a moment, even the PLO, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Organization that was formed by Yasser Arafat, which we had the PA that came out of Oslo, even that in its current form is rejected by America and the Israeli occupation entity, despite the fact that Israel itself was the signatory to the Oslo Accords. And we saw that Palestine fulfilled its side, but the Israeli occupation entity didn't fulfill their side. So the PA is rejected. You know, Israel reached a point of annexing the West Bank despite, you know, the Oslo Accord splitting it up into areas A, B, C, etc. And that goes to the heart of the matter, and that is because the PA was not their creation, despite the fact that the PA takes orders from the Israeli occupation entity and follows them. But ultimately, they want to form the authority in control. Of course, in all of this, the resistance is also rejected, which is inherently a part and parcel of the people. And the people have made their decision. We've seen it clear in the past 2 years from the people of Gaza that they stand with the resistance as well.
Right, I want to continue another conversation, bringing Ajamu to the conversation. Really, how can an externally mandated stabilisation force, a so-called ISF, ever be legitimate without the consent of the people it is going to rule on?
It can't be. This is what makes this whole proposal so unserious, that this is an idea that is bound to fail because it continues to sideline the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. I think this will be a dark date in the history of the United Nations when it becomes clear, I think it's already clear, that the United Nations has basically allowed itself to be bullied by the United States of America into, in essence, surrendering its legitimacy and its power to the United States of America. This idea that the U.S. should have the authority to, along with the Israeli fascists that created the genocide and continued the occupation, the idea that they should be allowed to govern a Palestinian people who are involved in a legitimate struggle of decolonization, a struggle that has as its objective self-determination, it puts the United Nations on the side of the colonizer. This is a absolute departure from the values and the principles of the United Nations and its charter. So this is absolutely outrageous and should be rejected by most of the nations on this planet.
Right. Batul, considering the different dimensions of this new resolution, which has gone past, you know, the UN Security Council, how much do you think it risks becoming a new form of trusteeship or colonial administration, you know, under international cover?
Yes. Ultimately, this goes to the crux of what we're seeing in the region. The whole region is colonized and not stabilized. This needs to be made clear. When we look at Gaza today, more than half of it is already occupied by Israel. So it's not a matter of the ISF risking becoming a colonial administration. The whole of Gaza is besieged today. If you look at even its neighbors, you look at Lebanon, you look at Syria, they're routinely bombed. You look at the Persian Gulf countries, you look at Egypt, you look at Saudi Arabia, they operate under a form of American colonialism in that they are under American dictates. Today, the whole region, this phase of U.S. colonization in the region is at its worst phase because America today is fully calling the shots in terms of how to deal, what is considered acceptable, what isn't. It seeks to get the world's countries to bow with different kinds of excuses. And if we look even beyond continents, from Venezuela to Cuba, using the excuse of the war on drugs, in Lebanon today, we see the American paper openly being called as such, and that it needs to be enacted under threats or else Lebanon will be invaded. Today, America is the one giving the dictates and outlining its visions and what it wants to be fulfilled. And we see those dictates, for example, I gave the example of Lebanon, being given to the Lebanese army that is funded by the U.S. You know, we see it canceling its scheduled meetings with the Lebanese army commander because, you know, Lebanon's statement is clearly blaming Israel for its tensions rather than the resistance.
Right.
But today, what we see is the political and military hegemony is from the U.S. The structures are theirs. The leadership is theirs, as they want it in Gaza, and they decide who fulfills what. So today in Gaza, they want to give the reconstruction to the Persian Gulf countries, the money from them. You have troops in the ISF, they're talking about troops from Islamic countries supposedly being integrated. They want to almost create a contradiction here between even Muslim governments and the people. So we see the decisions of the Security Council ultimately within this framework, which are all inherently colonial.
Right. Achamo, the UN, of course, is called United Nations. It is supposed to be independent. How do you think it can reconcile stabilization with the principle of self-determination so enshrined in its own charter?
It's impossible. And that's really the point, that basically this is a significant departure from the United Nations Charter. This is historic in its implications. And so, as the guest just indicated, this is a reflection of the new power dynamics that basically over the last 2 years, what we have seen unfold in West Asia has been a program of domination, a program that had at the center of its objective the reestablishment of U.S. hegemony in the region, operating through its proxy, Fort Israel. And we the vote the other day in the United Nations was just a culmination of this process. So these principles cannot be reconciled, and that's why they are bound to fail. What is going to be the role of this international stabilization force if the resistance continues, and it will continue? Would they be given a mandate to go in shooting and murdering Palestinian people? This is something that it is unworkable. And again, it's something that we should reject. The only legitimate force that can be inserted is a force under the command of the United Nations with the full cooperation and permission given by the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. Anything short of that is colonialization.
Right, and Batul, how will this ISF is going to engage with de facto local authorities without legitimizing armed control or excluding constituencies?
Right, so within the UN resolution, I mean, there's several things, right? You have that Board of Peace, and then you have the ISF that's overseen by it, and the idea is that it would coordinate with Egypt and the Israeli occupation forces. And their job ultimately would be to train the Palestinians that they want, and that they bring to then control the strip. So they are a police state, you know, made up of countries, and one of its jobs is to hit the existing infrastructure that they seek to get rid of. And you also have a Palestinian executive committee, this is outlined within the resolution, that manages the day-to-day governance within the Gaza Strip. So basically technocrats taking care of the civil administration of the state again, in coordination between Egypt and the Israeli occupation entity. And within that, you have supporting nations like Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, and the US. One important point that I want to raise over here, when we talk about, you know, like the second phase, is, you know, even this 52% of Gaza that is occupied now by Israel, it is clear from this resolution that Israel will not withdraw and will not leave until there is this alternative force ready to govern within the American structure, American created. And all of this means that the second phase, including the withdrawal of the IOF, is hanging and is not bound by time, but by procedures that are very difficult to actualize, because its actualization includes removal of the Gazan resistance. And what does disarmament even mean? You know, what does it mean to destroy the tunnels? What could not be achieved during those 2 years of exercising the maximum degree of force it can apply on Gaza in terms of achieving its objectives, Israel will not be able to achieve during a time of peace. So it will not eliminate the resistance, no part of it, nor its supportive environment. And the mere existence and continuation of the idea and of those who carry the idea of resistance and who remain steadfast on this land means that even the political negotiations cannot replace the military force in extracting what is sought to be extracted. And in the ongoing and existing crisis in Palestine, that is, we're seeing a transformation occurring within the active internal situation that is rejecting this reality. For example, never at any point in time was the resistance able to recruit the number of fighters that it's able to recruit now.
Well, of course, Achamo, I want to talk a little bit about the European Union. Well, the collective West seems to be of a unified stance when it comes to this resolution. But at the same time, the European Union has warned against any changes in the demographic or the territorial integrity of Gaza and Palestine. Where does this concern come from, do you think?
No, I mean, it comes from their insistence on this fiction of a two-state solution. And I say fiction because the Israeli authorities have made it quite clear that they oppose any Palestinian state anywhere in the region. So where is the basis of peace, and where is the basis of a so-called two-state solution? So this is a continuation of Oslo, a continuation of the fiction that the European nations are committed to Palestinian rights in a Palestinian state. The historic experience suggests to us that we can't really take them seriously, that basically they are in alignment with the interests of the U.S. They will articulate some concerns because of their attempts to try to continue to pretend to be the defenders of international law and human rights. Gaza has exposed the true nature, not only of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli colonial project, but it stripped away any veneer that the West had any kind of commitment to anything called human rights and international law.
Right, Ajam, I want to continue this with you. You mentioned the two-state solution, which is like what the European Union wants and insists on. How do you think this two-state solution goes along with the transitional governance form and model that has been designated for this ISF?
It's impossible to... They can't reconcile these two ideals, because basically, if you are not prepared to allow the Palestinians to exercise authentic self-determination, then there's no solution. There's no peace process. That's why it's a misnomer to even refer to this as a peace process. This is a demand for the surrendering of the Palestinian resistance. This is a demand that any aspirations for Palestinian self-determination be abandoned. What is unique about this process is that we have a situation developing where you have sort of a new creation of a whole colonial administration, that the Israelis have been almost forced to give up some degree of control over Gaza,
right,
to the interest of the United States of America.
Right. And Batul, I want to focus on Russia and China's role. And they abstained rather than like voting negative to this resolution. I want to talk. I want you to tell me, what do you think? How does this reflect wider concerns regarding the implementation and implications of this resolution on the future of Palestine?
Right. I mean, Russia and China abstaining, I mean, ultimately that means they, at the heart of it, were against this resolution, but they don't have alternatives. And they also have reservations. Ultimately, this proves to me even more the point that, practically speaking, this plan of America will not work. And ultimately, that's because the Palestinians have proven that they will not accept to be besieged and occupied. And that's what October the 7th was a result of. But at the same time, no one should expect the liberation in Palestine to come from anywhere other than the Palestinians themselves. I mean, in 2 years of a genocide, we've not seen China reduce its trade relations with the Israeli occupation entity, which is its largest trade partner. I mean, in 2024 alone, like, the total goods trade between the entity and China was up to 16 billion, and it was up around 10% from 2023, and its imports actually rose in 2024. And likewise with Russia, I mean, Russia has its interests with the occupation entity too. You have its, you know, Zionist Jewish oligarchs within Russia. You've got over 1 million, you know, citizens of the Israeli occupation entity who also have Russian citizenship. So ultimately, it's shown that Russia and China are not willing to upset the United States of America when it comes to this, and they're almost waiting for the battle to come to their yard, if you will, in order to stand up and to take this kind of action. So ultimately, no liberation for Palestine will happen except at the hands of the Palestinians, and the Palestinians have proven that they are absolutely steadfast, and they will not give up. And we know that occupations, transgressions, torture, besiegement, they're all tools of savagery that are practiced against the Palestinian nation so it can remain isolated and has nothing. But resistance emerging and solidifying itself is very natural. It's not natural for there to be no resistance based on the extent of the transgression that is occurring. And if we look at the results, I mean, the Oslo Accords happened 3 decades ago, and October the 7th happened 3 decades after it. So occupation will only breed resistance, and even international law itself gives legitimacy to armed resistance as a reaction to occupation, and ultimately the whole world today is at a completely different place due to this confrontation. The world has woken up.
Right, Ajamu, I want to talk a little bit about the operational mechanics of this ISF ruling model. What mechanisms, with Egypt and Israel controlling the borders, will be there without entrenching external control over Palestinian free movement?
Well, I mean, the control will be total. And I'm more concerned about the so-called training of a force internally within the Gaza Strip by Egypt and the occupation forces. Because that spells a force that would be completely in opposition to the Palestinian people themselves. There's nothing about this plan that makes any real sense, that these folks seem to be operating in an alternative universe. And you know, the very fact that we have to give this some time and some degree of legitimacy, you know, it just sort of compounds the fact that you know, these forces have the ability to recreate reality, if you will. But in their attempt to do that, they devise processes and policies that undermine their own objectives. They're not going to be able to implement this plan, this so-called peace plan in Gaza. The history of anti-colonial struggles have supported that. So basically what we're going to see now is a continuation of the suffering of the Palestinian people. And we're going to see, I think, a certain kind of destabilization taking place, even in some of those states that have signed on to this fictional process.
Right. And it's very unfortunate, of course, to hear and to witness. Well, Batul, one final question for you. How will the mission ensure compliance with international humanitarian law and avoid actions resembling occupation?
Simply because
impossible.
America is in charge.
Now, go ahead, Batul. I wanted you to answer this question.
Absolutely. And I echo exactly what the guest has just said. It's absolutely impossible to ascertain that because we've just had 2 years of genocide in which it was perpetrated by America that is putting this supposed peace plan forward. So the one that is orchestrating it ultimately is the one who perpetrated the genocide. It's crazy, right? They come under the guise of peace. So all of a sudden now they're talking about peace, whereas they were the proponents of the genocide. And now they're talking about reconstruction and making something out of Gaza when these weapons, Israel could not have conducted this genocide for one day without the American support. So it's absolutely impossible. And what do we expect to see? We expect to see further resistance and the Palestinians remaining steadfast.
Right. And one final question for Ajamu. Of course, will there be any independent bodies investigating alleged abuses by all actors, including the ISF?
There should be. I mean, this should fall under the authority, under the auspices of the United Nations Human Rights Council. You have, of course, the Special Rapporteur. So there should be, close scrutiny, because we anticipate nothing but the continuation of violence, not at the level of the last 2 years, perhaps, but violence nevertheless. And this is a situation that suggests to us that in the end, we're going to have an explosion, not only in Gaza itself, but across West Asia, when the masses of the people understand the collusion that their states have been involved in, collusion with the collective West against the Palestinian people, and the indignity of that, we're going to see, I think, massive political destabilization across West Asia.
Right, thank you so much. It was indeed a pleasure to have you on this program. Ajamu Baraka, founder of Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York, and Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Now, the ISF in Gaza embodies a profound tension, stabilization for some, colonialization for others. This spotlight leaves open the question of whether international intervention can truly secure peace without eroding Palestinian sovereignty. Thank you, Aya Bahman Roy.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So truly, what an honor it is to be speaking about the beautiful dialogues and conversations of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar ibn Muhammad al-Sadiq alayhi salam. So there is an interesting dialogue that occurs between Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and one of His Eminence's companions. So the companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he asked His Eminence about fasting, and he asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam to give him some advice as regards to fasting and, you know, how one should fast in the holy month of Ramadan specifically. But fasting in general, of course. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he responded, "If you fast, try preventing your ears, your eyes, and your tongues from doing what is wrong and disallowed. Leave arguing, hurting servants, and try treating them in a way to show the mercifulness. Do not make the day on which you fast be the same as the day you do not. And so a very beautiful response here that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam gave about fasting. Of course, he said, if you fast, because, you know, there might be certain jurisprudential and fiqhi reasons why an individual might not be able to fast. But if you are fasting, then, you know, your eyes and your ears and your tongues should also be fasting, in the sense that, you know, you refrain from committing sins with at least those parts of your body, if not all parts of your body. You know, how many things we see which are improper, how many things we hear that are improper, and sometimes because of fasting, how many things we say that are improper, you know. And the holy month of Ramadan is really on the horizon. It's not that far away, maybe a couple of months away is the holy month of Ramadan. And so this idea that, you know, we should make our fasting day different than our other regular days. You know, this is something that is constantly reminded to us from the various different speakers in the holy month of Ramadan, you know, that our fasting day should be better and purer and more perfect, if you will, from the rest of our days in, you know, our life. And, you know, we find that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, of course, this is this piece of advice that His Eminence put forward. This is a piece of advice, excuse me, you know, that is more spiritual. We know him more for his scientific endeavors, his hadith and traditions that he spoke about. We also know, you know, about his medicinal and medical achievements, scientific achievements, astronomical, you know, achievements, and these kind of things. But rarely do we really focus on this very beautiful ethics and morals and akhlaqi aspect of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. This is Dialogue, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam was the oldest imam, other than Imam al-Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala faraja. He was the oldest serving imam. He lived for about 68 years. Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam was born in the holy city of Medina, and the Imam alayhi salam was also martyred in the city of Medina. He was born in the year 80 after the hijrah, and he was martyred year 148. Now, what gave Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam the opportunity to educate thousands of students is the political crisis during his time. The Umayyads had wreaked havoc in the Muslim Ummah. People were fed up with their injustice, with their tyranny. And there were many revolutions against the Umayyads. So there were people who were bringing down the Umayyad dynasty. And the Abbasids, they were carrying a banner and they were saying, we want the rule for the family of the Prophet, for Al-Muhammad. This was their slogan. Some people came to Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and they told him, should we participate in these revolutions? Should we side with the Abbasids and their people? The Imam said, no. You think these people are truthful? These people just want power. They don't really want the Ahlul Bayt to rule. They want the power for themselves. So I don't recommend that you get involved in this political crisis. So the Umayyad dynasty falls. The Abbasid dynasty is rising. There was a gap. There was a vacuum for a few decades. That gave Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam freedom to teach. At 1,400 students would attend his lessons. Can you imagine that 14 centuries ago, 13 centuries ago? 4,000 students listening to him, writing his knowledge, not just in legal studies and fiqh, not just in the Holy Quran and the tafsir of the Holy Quran, in astronomy, in chemistry, in biology, in all of these sciences, the Imam alayhi salam was raising a generation of scholars.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Plants grow and give fruits and flowers when they are in the most ideal circumstances. Proper amount of sun, water, soil conditions, and the right temperature are all the ingredients for a happy plant to grow and do what it does best. These days, being a successful farmer is a much more complicated and demanding profession than in the past. Farmers today not only need to have great agricultural skills, but they also must have exceptional technological and marketing expertise. And the most recent trend in farming are greenhouses.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. In this program, we will explore new developments in Iran's vast agriculture industry while shining the spotlight on greenhouses. We wanted to see what all the fanfare is about with this type of farming. Plus, we will also check out how it's making profits in the agriculture sector. So plant yourself in a comfortable seat and let's start the show.
Our journey began at Farakish the Parsian. This company has been around for decades and has a rich history of activity in livestock rearing and farming. Some years ago, it launched a new business specializing in high-tech hydroponic greenhouses. It's an indoor farm with greenhouses built on many hectares of land. Mainly, it grows three types of produce and a variety of tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce. Each year, it may focus on growing a single type of crop, such as peppers. They have perfected Mother Nature indoors through a combination of science and technology married with farming. The goal is to provide sustainable indoor farming solutions that optimize the use of natural resources. Hydroponic greenhouses grow crops in nutrient-rich water, so water management is at the heart of this company. The structures are created with state-of-the-art irrigation systems. Also, rainwater is collected and distributed to plants. Drainage from the plants is gathered in pools where it undergoes a purification process to remove contaminants, then recycled back into the system. But that's not all. Special ventilation systems control temperature and air circulation. The greenhouses are equipped with shades to control natural light, plus they are fitted with heating and cooling systems. This type of farming comes at a time when the country is witnessing unprecedented heat and water shortages, partially because of outdated agricultural practices.
This type of farming is growing in popularity. The technical term for hydroponic farming is controlled environmental agriculture, or simply indoor farming. These greenhouses create precise growing conditions using technological advances like digital monitoring that draw out the best flavors and textures in produce. And they can be built almost anywhere.
Aside from being a major producer itself, this company offers its hydroponic technology to farmers and growers. Plus, it helps them plant their own greenhouses. It gets its seedlings from its own massive nursery. The seeds are hybrids that are imported. Using hybrid seeds helps grow crops that match international quality, which is beneficial when exporting their produce. This company collaborates with research and academic institutions for agricultural research of cash crops, such as saffron and blueberries. The company stands on the threshold of exporting its produce and welcomes foreign investments to expand its activities. As part of their future vision, they are creating a program for on-site training, which helps users of hydroponic technology in glass greenhouses. Additionally, it is developing lodging and accommodation for national and international agritourists. The most recent addition to their line of work is a packing facility, which packages produce and readies them for market distribution. While the U.S. sanctions do not directly cover the agriculture sector, they have indirectly impacted businesses in this industry. Much of the technology used in this company is imported or has spare parts that need to be imported. The sanctions have hindered international money transfers, making imports and even exports of produce for this company difficult.
As you might know, open land farming is vulnerable to environmental changes. Droughts, cold spells, heat waves, and soil erosion all impact harvests. The agriculture sector not only plays a big role in managing food security, but also is a big contributor to the Iranian economy. In recent years, water shortages have slowed development in this sector, which has gained the attention of government officials.
The Ministry of Agriculture defines several programs to develop greenhouses to tackle drought conditions. Right now, the total greenhouse area in the country stands at around 21,000 hectares. Government officials want to increase this amount to 25,000 by the end of the year. This will help support plans of the Ministry of Agriculture to transfer vegetable farms to greenhouses. The main objective is to save 10 billion cubic meters of water annually. Many of these greenhouses are set up in agriculture parks inside free trade zones. In fact, in the Northwest, Aras Free Trade Zone opened one of the biggest hydroponic greenhouse complexes in West Asia. The goal is to increase productions for exports. For this reason, agri-parks have a major role in developing technology to support efficient indoor farming. The government provided nearly $200 million worth of funds for creating agricultural parks and greenhouses last year. And this supportive measure has paid off, as over 4 million tons of fruits and vegetables were produced this year from greenhouses. Tehran province is one of the country's biggest producers of greenhouse products. Yazd, West Azerbaijan, Bushehr, and Khorasan provinces also have numerous greenhouses, just to name a few.
Iranian agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It was one of the only sectors that was barely impacted by the global coronavirus outbreak. Agriculture is not limited to cultivation and farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. It is considered a strategic sector where goods are enhanced with added value through processing promotion, and distribution.
Agriculture makes up 8% of Iran's GDP and employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. Iran's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports last year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture. Figures from the ministry show Iran has over 18 million hectares of arable land. And last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced in farmlands. Iran's agro industry is worth billions. Data from Iran's Customs Administration show the value of the country's agricultural exports rose by around 3% this year. Its figures also reveal Iran exported some 5 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $3 billion this year. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list was pistachio, selling off roughly $540 million worth of nuts. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture products also generated $1 billion in exports.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
We live in a world where our lives are becoming increasingly intertwined with the zeros and ones. We transfer money, we call our friends, and we do our shopping using these two magic numbers that form the foundation of the virtual yet real world that's called IT. Today, I'll walk you around this Iranian company that has a lot to say when it comes to the IT sector. Here, only the impossible is impossible. The motto, which Ida Bonyane Mobtakere Pars has set its targets on, the Iranian brand develops a range of IT and ICT products, from apps and websites to educational content. The idea of launching such a business was developed more than a decade and a half ago, in the mind of its CEO, when he was just a high school student. E-commerce is one of the amazing outcomes of the digital space. The emergence of online shopping has provided an instant link between customers and sellers, where customers can easily window shop and get their hands on their desired items in a tap of a finger.
Minikala is the name of a newbie online shopping app that's developed by the thriving brand. In less than 2 years, the number of Minikala users is rapidly approaching 500K. Ida Bonyane Mobtakere Pars is an umbrella company that has under its belt a range of startups, producing apps with different purposes, from money management apps to shopping and medical applications. This is what makes this firm stand out from the ever-growing number of rivals in Iran.
Digital marketing is a newbie business in Iran, but still, there are many companies, Iranian companies, who have stepped into the realm of the digital marketing or e-commerce. Despite its adverse effect on the global economy, when it comes to digital marketing, the coronavirus pandemic was a blessing, making the online space the safest possible channel for people to get their hands on different products. And this company says it fares even better during the pandemic.
With a dedicated team, bringing together more than 150 highly driven programmers, Mobtakere says it tries to expand the scope of its activity based on the needs of the day. Otherwise, it would stay behind in the fast-paced market.
Many thanks for that awesome report. And that wraps up our show for today. Until next time, take care. We'll see you again on another episode of Bazaar.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ لئن أذقناه نعماء